Good morning, everyone. I'm going ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order this morning. Thank you very much for being here. We have a number of bills that are up for a public hearing and possible work session. If I've counted correctly, I believe there are five. We have three that we're going to, and I, Representative Val, should I open up for all three at once?
Might as well.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and open up public hearings on House Bill 3056, House Bill 3057A, as well as House Bill 3059A. And Representative, why don't you go ahead and come on up, and if you want to bring anyone with you at this point, feel free to do that. If not, I do have individuals that are signed up for the different bills.
Yes, Chair Przanski, Rich Vile, House District 26, and I'll bring up an individual witness on each bill, if that's all right.
That's great.
Do you want to have counsel introduce it, or shall I go ahead and introduce the bill?
So this is what, just to put everyone on page, I've got Whitney Perez with me today. These bills were assigned to Josh Nasby, but he had another issue that came up, so he's not able to be with us this morning, so please bear with us. Whitney will give us just a brief overview, and so we would like for you to maybe supplement wherever it's appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, on House Bill 3056, 3057, and 3059 are both bills that deal with HOAs, or condominium and homeowners associations. On 3056, we do not have any amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact. On 3057, we also have no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact. And on 3059, I believe we don't have any amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Rich Vile, House District 26. And as some of you may know, I'm a recovering attorney. I spent about 35 years doing mostly homeowner association law, and so it's fallen to me to work on these kinds of bills here, which I'm grateful to have the opportunity to do. And before I go any further, I just need to make one disclaimer. You're going to hear from two witnesses today that are from the law firm of Vile Fotheringham, which was a firm that I started. However, I sold my interest in December of 2015 and therefore am not declaring any conflicts of interest as we work forward on these bills and we hear from folks that work with my law firm. The first bill that we're going to talk about is
with your former law firm.
With my former law firm. Thank you very much. bit of a Freudian slip there. Thank you, Senator. First bill we're going to talk about is House Bill 3056. It was about 30 years ago that I sat in this very room as a young lawyer talking about the idea that homeowners associations really needed the ability to have a lien against the property to secure the unpaid homeowner association assessments. Those assessments are typically imposed to maintain the property, to administer the property, to purchase insurance, et cetera. And at that time, there was no lien available that was an automatic lien per se, and we were working on making sure that that association would be secured, much like property taxes are secured in our government system. We did, in fact, then from that point on have the automatic lien. We also had the ability to avoid foreclosure on that lien so that we didn't have to necessarily take someone's property interest away by suing on the obligation and securing a judgment. And then we could execute on that judgment by the various means that we have for executing on judgments. We had a judge not too long ago decide that if we secured a judgment, that would extinguish the lien. And the problem with that is that once we had the judgment, even though we hadn't collected on it yet, the association lost its security interest. This bill corrects that. Tim Zimmerman of my former law firm is here today with us, and he's going to talk just a bit more about that.
Thank you. Tim?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Tim Zimmerman. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Vile Fotheringham. I'm here on behalf of the Community Associations Institute, and I urge your support for 3056. I need to make one correction from what Representative Vile said. I don't believe there was a judge that made a ruling, but there was a judge that intimated that that would be the ruling and never came to fruition. Homeowner associations, condominium associations rely on assessments to fund their common expenses. Those unpaid assessments, as Representative Vile said, are a lien against the homeowner's property. If a homeowner becomes delinquent in the payment of the assessments, the association needs to seek payment through legal means. Typically, other homeowners in the community must make up the difference if a homeowner does not pay his assessments. If legal action is necessary, the association has two options: either sue for the money judgment or commence a foreclosure proceeding. The preferred method, of course, is to sue for the money judgment. Associations really do not want to have to foreclose. Foreclosure is the last option. Current law provides that an action to recover a money judgment for unpaid assessments may be maintained without foreclosing or waiving a lien for unpaid assessments. Recovery on the action operates to satisfy the lien or portion thereof for which recovery is made. Some believe, however, that the meaning of recovery on the action is not clear. Thus, House Bill 3056 is intended to clarify that obtaining a money judgment does not waive the association's homeowner association lien. The association lien will continue notwithstanding that the association has obtained a money judgment. It further makes clear that if any association receives payment of the judgment, the amount of the lien is also reduced by the same amount. This clarification is important because if an association believes it's at risk of losing its lien and its lien priority when it obtains a money judgment, the association is more likely to choose the foreclosure option out of necessity. HB 3056 makes clear that associations could avoid foreclosure actions in favor of the less severe money judgment option. Therefore, we urge your support on House Bill 3056. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Question, Senator Manning first.
Well, just, Mr. Chair, just for full disclosure, I used to be president of a HOA, and I attended a number of Vile Fotheringham's seminars or training annually. So I want to just get that out there. I'm no longer president of the HOA, but I want to put it out there.
So you're a former president?
I'm a former president.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Of a former firm.
A former firm.
All right. Any other questions?
Senator Linthicum.
Just a question with regard to satisfying the entire amount. I don't think I noticed the reduction, you know, from the judgment to the lien language in here. Can you point that out to me?
It is in there, if you bear with me a moment. On page 3 of the House bill, line 20 starts at 20 through 23. That's 4 sub C. And it says, a judgment entered on the action does not extinguish the lien. Payment on the judgment operates to satisfy the lien or a portion of the lien to the extent of the payment received.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you very much. Let me just ask if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony on House Bill 3056. Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead. And I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. We still have the other two open, and so we'll
thank
take
you.
Testimony on House Bill 3057A. And I believe we're going to have David, is it Schwind?
Schwind, yes. Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, Rich Vile, State Representative, House District 26. Here today on House Bill 3057A, by way of very brief background, Oregon has one of the strongest requirements in the country for a homeowners association to maintain reserves necessary to replace the common elements so that folks are not hit with special assessments when it's time to replace a roof or some other major facility. Naturally, it is necessary for those associations to keep track of how their common elements are doing. We have folks like Mr. Schwint, who you'll hear from in a moment, who's an accountant that specializes in calculating the amount of money that that association should have on hand and determining what portions of the project need to be taken into consideration in making those calculations. This bill actually came out of a conversation with Representative Greenlick, who had a situation where an association was not maintaining its common elements appropriately, and it resulted in actually a safety issue with respect to some sidewalks. Mr. Schwint has worked with the folks in this industry to come up with language that clarifies and strengthens the requirements on associations to maintain those reserves.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is David Schwint. I am a certified public accountant in the state of Oregon, also a reserve specialist. My firm works with over 500 homeowner associations in the Pacific Northwest, providing reserve studies, audits, reviews, and tax work. I also represent today Community Associations Institute, which is a national organization that provides educational programs and materials to boards of directors of homeowner associations throughout the United States. Oregon has its own local chapter, the Oregon Chapter of Community Associations Institute. I'm also representing today Oregon-Washington Community Association Manager Organization, which represents managers of community associations in Oregon and Washington. So I want to thank Representative Vile for explaining what a reserve study is. It's merely a 30-year cash flow budget that assists boards of directors of condominium associations and homeowner associations in determining how much they need to save every month and every year. So when it comes time to write the check for a new roof or painting, siding, windows, decks, those types of common area components, there's enough money in the bank account to provide for that. The current statute as it reads does a good job of explaining what a reserve study is, what components should be reserved for, and how to come up with the required monthly and annual contribution to provide for future repairs and replacements and to pay for those expenditures. What the current statute doesn't do is provide much guidance on what an update is. Current statute requires that you have a reserve study and annually that you update that reserve study. Current statute really doesn't have a lot of guidance on what constitutes an update. What this statute does is it just clarifies what's involved in an update. And it's pretty common sense types of clarification. You need to revisit the costs of repair, inflation, beginning balances, and this actually came out of some confusion out in the industry on just what an update is. So again, this is merely a clarification of the existing statute as it pertains to reserve study updates.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for the explanation. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 3057A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. And that leaves the remaining one open is 3059A.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, Rich Vile, House District 26. Here on House Bill 3059, when a condominium or planned community, those projects that we call homeowners associations, is developed. It is developed by a developer who we call a declarant. And the reason we use the word declarant is that a declaration is recorded. The declaration is sort of like a master deed. And if you think of it in the ancient English process where you went out into a field with a bundle of sticks and one guy handed certain sticks to the person that a transfer was being made to, the deed describes what the bundle of sticks was that has been transferred to individual owners. And what is retained by the association, anciently the king, in terms of common oversight. That declaration often contains special provisions that allow the developer or declarant to do things that the rest of the association can't do for an extended period of time. Add units, develop common areas, change roads and streets, things like that. And those sorts of things can last for a very limited period of time in Oregon on some projects, or they can last forever depending on how that declaration is written. We had a situation in Oregon where a declarant sold the units in a project, had a block of units at the end that were unsold, sold those units to a third-party developer. That third-party developer then went ahead and sold the rest of the units. The declarant came back many years later and said, and bought a unit and said, well, I'm listed as the declarant in the declaration, and I now own a unit in this place. I'm going to convert some of the common area into additional units. Obviously, the Homeowners Association was not happy about that. That ended up in a very expensive, several hundred thousand dollar court case, actually right here in Marion County. And in order to avoid that kind of misunderstanding, this bill merely makes it clear that once you have disposed of your interest as a declarant, a subsequent re-entry to the project by that declarant does not reestablish your declarant rights. You've given them up once you've completely disposed of it. Greg Coxey of a former law firm that I was associated with is here with us today, and he's going to say a few more words about that.
Senator, Chair Pazansky, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Greg Coxey. I'm a partner with the law firm of Isle Fotheringham, but here on behalf of Community Association Institute, the Portland chapter, as well as the Oregon Washington Community Association managers. I also am in Representative Isle's House District and Senator Thatcher's Senate District as well. This bill, as Representative Vile described, is a clarification on those declarant rights. This idea has been commonly interpreted where your declarant rights end once those rights are given up, and so this is a clarification of the law. There's no financial impact. This is, you know, merely in an effort to clarify what is the interpretation and to make it clear. So if we run into cases where there's ongoing litigation, there's something that we can refer back to. So I urge your support on this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Lithicum?
I believe I read at the tail end of this and don't have it before me, but if the transferor sells on Tuesday, comes back in on Wednesday buying that same portion that he transferred away, does he receive all of those rights back, or does this negate that? I'm just, you know, coming up with an oddball scheme. Instead of the what you described, where there was coming back in on a single parcel and then claiming to have these rights, if I liquidate my share of these rights a year later, instead of Tuesday or Wednesday later, purchase all of those rights back, does this prevent me from gaining those rights?
Chair Pazansky, Senator Lithicum, there is a provision what we called the fail-safe provision that does allow a developer or declarant in the deal that they pass the block along to retain the right to come back in if it's that commercial kind of transaction. But this bill would avoid the one-off, come back, buy a unit, and try to do something that everybody thought you had given up. As long as it's in the document at that initial transfer away that I can come back in, there's that fail-safe.
Okay.
Senator Dimbro?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Is there any other questions or comments? Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 3059A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. So, we'll do that. Okay. So, what we're going to do, I have another member here, Representative Vowell. I'm going to go ahead and take that testimony. We'll work these bills. I think we have everything ready to go today. That will give me an opportunity to figure out how we will be dispersing the bills for the floor. And so we'll take care of that, but I want to go ahead and open
and with the chair's permission, I'm going to head back to the committee I've got to go to.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming forward today and giving us your testimony on those three bills. So at this point, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing, and I believe it's the 3176A, and as I have Representative Williamson coming up, I neglected to just introduce for those who are here. Tomery is sitting over to my left, and for those who have not met her, she is a intern with my office. She's part of the State Department's Professional Fellowship Program. She is from the country of Georgia, an attorney in her own right, and she is with my office during the month of May. And so this is her first time to be in the USA, and I think the first time for her to be sitting here with us for our hearings. So, Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Chair Puzanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I am the state representative for House District 36 on the west side of Portland. As we all know, the number of women incarcerated in the United States has grown exponentially in the last 40 years. According to government statistics, the number of women in prison has increased 700% since 1980. And in Oregon, nearly 56,000 women are either behind bars or on probation. And colleagues, I think we're learning more and more about how women end up in the criminal justice system. And I hope as policymakers, we continue to look at this issue and craft gender-specific policies to help address the needs of these women. Nationwide, the number of women in prison in the United States who attribute their incarceration to a relationship with a batterer is staggering. As of 2003, the number was between 80 and 85%. And 79% of women in the federal and state prison system report being the victim of physical abuse. As these statistics show, many women who are being incarcerated are victims of violence, coercion, and abuse. And in many cases, we may be adding to the overall harm done to these women and their children by not taking this abuse into account. I believe we can better serve the cause of justice by allowing judges to consider such domestic violence or abuse in the sentencing process. This bill authorizes the court in Oregon to consider whether a person who committed a crime was commanded or coerced to do so by a person who had committed domestic violence against them. Under current state law, the factors the court shall consider during a sentencing phase are any evidence received during the proceeding, the pre-sentence report where one is available, any other evidence relevant to aggravation or mitigation that the court finds trustworthy and reliable, and the courts may also consider the defendant's status as a service member. While the courts currently have considerable latitude in considering a variety of factors during the sentencing phase, there's nothing in this statute that specifically guides the court to consider domestic violence, and this bill changes that. Across the country, seven states have similar statutes already enacted. This bill would ensure that important information about trauma women may have experienced that could have put them into the criminal justice system is part of the consideration of their punishment. I thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I urge your eye support.
All right, thank you. And it looks like we have two individuals that are up to give testimony. Jessica, I'm sorry, I can't read your...
Campy?
Campy, and then Sarah Voroshamai.
Vershani.
All right. So sorry for the butchering of the names, but who would like to be next?
I would like to be next.
Okay.
Members of the committee, co-chairs, thank you. My name is Jessica Campfee. I'm the executive director at the Public Defender of Marion County. I wanted to speak to say today that in our experience, it's actually a very common profile for women offenders to have this kind of trauma history. And so we do think that this is a very important bill to recognize that history. In my experience, I've represented many, many women that have this kind of trauma history. One stands out to me. I was co-counsel on a murder case a couple years ago where our client, a woman client, had shot and killed her husband the day after Christmas. And she had been the victim of domestic abuse for about 30 years prior to this. On this particular date, she believed that her husband was going for a gun, and she grabbed the gun first and fired two shots, and he was killed. We worked with the district attorney's office, and our client actually testified at the grand jury, so thank you very much for your legislation that allowed that to happen. It made a big difference. The grand jury still indicted her, but on a lesser charge of criminally negligent homicide. She was still prison-bound on the case, but the district attorney did consider her trauma history and the domestic abuse history in the case and was willing to negotiate a downward departure to probation. So in that case, we did get a very good result for our client through negotiations, but that's not always the case. And so it is important that it's not just the district attorney that has the discretion to consider this kind of trauma history, but also that the judges have the discretion to make those considerations. Thank you.
Thank you. And Sarah?
Chair, co-chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Forashani, and I am a deputy public defender at the Public Defenders in Marion County. Jessica Campfee is my boss. I would like to share two stories with you. Amongst many stories that I do have, I have represented clients ranging from misdemeanors to now I do mid-level felonies. Most recently, I had a client who was being forced by her abuser to engage in organized retail shoplifting. When she was arrested, her first words to the officer was, "Thank you, Jesus, I am finally escaping my abuser." She was charged with a felony level theft. Through gaining letters from her domestic violence advocate and gaining other mitigation, we were able to negotiate the case down from a felony to a misdemeanor. The district attorney, the assigned district attorney to the case, did note that the only reason that she did negotiate the case down to a misdemeanor was because she had no criminal history. Unfortunately, this is not the case for many of our clients who do endure lifelong trauma from being abused, specifically domestic violence. Another story I would like to share with you is a client who was arrested for prostitution. She would not admit to being sex trafficked or to being violated in any way. But over the course of representing her for a year, I noticed her having busted lips, black eyes, bruises everywhere on her body. Sometimes she wouldn't even be able to talk. Building a relationship with her for that year, she did confide to me that she was being abused by her boyfriend, who she did leave. There was also other indicators that suggested that she was being sex trafficked, but she would not come off as far as saying that. The original district attorney that had that case would not negotiate and would not take any mitigation into consideration. It was very fortunate for her and for me that district attorney ended up leaving the office and the case was reassigned to another district attorney who did take these observations that I've made with the permission of my client to present it to the judge and to the district attorney to be able to negotiate that case. But that is just by mere luck that the case was reassigned. I believe that over the course of representing people for the last 3 years, that it would be greatly beneficial to the state of Oregon and to our clients and to the system to have the judge be able to decide this and to use their discretion rather than being at the mercy of the district attorneys.
All right, thank you. Questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 3176A? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 3176A. And we have all our paperwork, I'm assuming, so we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3176A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3176A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 3176A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. So regarding carriers, so Senator Thatcher, I'm going to give you your choice. Either you will carry this one or the next one that we're going to hear, which is coming out of the Attorney General, House Bill 2621.
I am happy to carry this one.
All right. Senator Thatcher will be the carrier on 3176A.
Wow. Choices. That's cool.
All right. So now we'll close that hearing, just our work session, and we're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing on House Bill 2621A.
And thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. House Bill 2621A modifies crime victims' compensations programs administered by the Department of Justice in several different ways. There is a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendments.
Great. Shannon, come on up. Aaron. All right. So.
It'll just be her.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Aaron Knott had to step out. My name is Shannon Savelle. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. And just briefly, for those of you who may not be familiar with the program, the Crime Victims Compensation Program was started in 1978. It provides victims of violent crime with financial assistance from medical, mental health counseling, funeral expenses, loss of earnings, and other expenses associated with their victimization. Over the last 2 years, we've worked very closely with victims' rights attorneys, victims and survivors, district attorneys' offices, and others to begin to kind of consider how we can make our program even more victim-centered and responsive. We have changed many of our internal policies and practices and the administrative rules, and it became necessary, we felt, or I felt, to actually make some changes to the statute to reflect the nature of our victim-centered approach to compensation, and so that victims would understand that they have access to this program. So what this amended statute does is clarify some current language, codify some longstanding practices that we've established through administrative rule, and create some new limited benefits for victims and survivors who might not otherwise qualify for crime victims compensation. Specifically, what it does is add sexual assault, stalking, and domestic violence to the existing presumption of good cause for failure to report to law enforcement. What it does is establish that a survivor may also satisfy the requirement to report to law enforcement by securing a temporary or permanent stalking order, restraining order, or sexual assault protective order. It creates a limited counseling benefit for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence who might not otherwise qualify for the program. It clarifies that law enforcement, the Department of Human Services, OIA, and DOC may release certain reports to our program for the express use of evaluating a claim and hopefully approving it for compensation. It allows us to pay for child forensic interviews, which is something new that was, I think, codified in the last legislative session. And it allows us to pay for prescription medication associated with survivor mental health counseling up to $1,500. The reason it does not have or has a limited fiscal impact, if any, is that this does not change the actual limits to the benefits that we can pay to survivors and victims of crime. So, for example, we pay up to $20,000 for medical expenses. This bill and some of the changes might allow greater flexibility within that $20,000 limit, but does not increase that limit. So we are not expecting to see any changes to our payouts. Additionally, we've been doing this for some time. Many of these policies we've already incorporated internally because we are allowed to make findings for good cause and exceptions of this nature, and we haven't seen an increase in our payouts. Lastly, due to the Affordable Care Act and other things, we're seeing that while our applications numbers are approximately the same, about 5,200 a year, we are actually paying out about half of what we were two biennia ago. So the bill passed, I think, unanimously out of the House, and I, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right, questions? Shannon, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2621A? Not seeing one, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2621A.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2621A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2621A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. The chair will carry House Bill 2621A to the floor. We'll close the work session and we'll open up work session on House Bill 3056. Colleagues, these are the bills that we heard earlier today, so we'll just work through those. And I think everything's ready to go.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3056 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 3056 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. We'll have the former president of the HOA carry this one, Senator Manning.
Thank you very much.
We'll close the work session on that. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 3057A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3057A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves House Bill 3057A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Lithicum, I'd like for you to carry this one if it's all right.
You bet.
All right, we'll close the work session on 3057A and open up the last work session in the trio here, House Bill 3059A.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3059A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 3059A. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I all these bills just kind of confirm to me why I'm not a member of an HOA.
Excellent. I have the same confirmation. Don't touch it. Stay away.
Exactly.
Do not trespass, as they would say.
You know, they're not bad.
Oh, boy. That's right. Yeah,
okay, right. Okay, so I'm carrying this one, too. So.
No, yeah. We'll see. All right, so any other comments on House Bill 3059A? Not any objection to the motion that's before us? All right, motion carries. Actually, we're going to have the good Senator Denborough carry this after hearing about common law and back in the days of the king. I figured Senator Denborough would be the appropriate individual to be carrying.
I'll make sure to bring my sticks, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 3059A. And we'll open up our work session that was a carryover from last week on House Bill 2673A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2673A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2673A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I had found out I had some concerns about debtors and creditors and all that, and if there would be an issue with not posting with the court, which is what I think the whole impetus of posting it with the court was about. And apparently, there is no concern. So,
yeah. And I was going to put on the record, too, we reached out. We checked for see what happened on the other side. There was no one that was coming in opposition or with concerns on the debtor side of the issues. Also, I do want to put on the record, because there was some discussion yesterday regarding sexual assault victims. It should be noted that current law and under this bill, not only do sexual assault victims, but others who have a compelling reason that can demonstrate to the court why notice should not be allowed, have that option. And so that is something that will go forward. And let's see, there was one other
thing.
And
Mr. Chair, maybe this will ring a bell, I don't know. It's also my understanding that if one goes through the administrative process here in the state, that it may or may not be recognized in another state. Is that correct?
That is correct. And this is one of the reasons for having both ways, retaining what we have now through the judicial process, as well as having this new one, which would be administrative. It's the way it's been explained to me is that if an individual plans to not stay in the state of Oregon and move to another jurisdiction, they may, with foresight, want to go through the judicial process, because that would be a judicial order, which under full faith and credit would be recognized in another state, as compared to if it was an administrative act there's no guarantee that that new state would actually honor that. So that is the other part. And I think that covers everything, unless other people have other comments.
The idea that one way is recognized and the other is not recognized, I think, is problematic. So I would object to this and like to just stick with the judicial process.
Okay.
I think that's a I don't think that individuals who are stepping into this stream are looking into the future, and they don't know over the next 5-10 years where their life is going to take them, and we now just caught them into another trap where they expected this to solve their problem and it didn't.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I would add to that that perhaps we want to instruct whoever is administering this to make sure that they are aware of that potential consequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My understanding is that is the goal of that occurring. I'm not ready to hold the bill up to put something else into it. We will put it on the record, though, as we have just now, that it would be appropriate and we think necessary that there be information given to individuals who are going who are seeking this type of action through the administrative process to, in fact, have some type of written information to inform them prior to them going through that process, the potential shortfalls or pitfalls that might occur through that. I think that's reasonable for that information. And I would also suggest, even though it does not require, I assume in many cases individuals will be seeking counsel, meaning legal representation through this process, and that they themselves will hopefully be giving their clients that information as well so they can make an informed decision. Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, just Senator Thatcher really made the comment that I did, that it would be useful for the organizations that aid people in taking this step, you know, to give them that advice so that they're making fully cognizant decisions. And, you know, with that, I think we need to respect people's freedom to make their own decisions, their liberty to do so. I think it's a strong value, so I support this.
All right. Any other comments? All right. Besides Senator Lithicum, is there anyone else objecting to the motion? Not seeing any. Motion carries, and the chair will carry House Bill 2673A to the floor. And we're going to go ahead and close the work session on that.
Were you going to co-carry it with
Yeah, I'm going to carry. I should put. I did tell Senator Roblin that I would have him carry, and I would be backup. So I will be second in line with Senator Roblin at least doing the opening. So with that, we're going to go ahead and close the work session. And thank you, Senator Denborough, for reminding me that. So before we close for the day, what I'm thinking is we're not going to have a committee on Monday. We're still waiting for the bill flow from the House to come through, and it just hasn't happened to the point. We were looking at next week at some of the days, and I think at this point we're set for Tuesday, Wednesday, and was Thursday open still?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Currently we're only scheduled for Tuesday, and then we've posted the no meeting on Monday, May 8th, and so we don't have anything from May 10th or May 11th yet. I'm seeing if we can do a prison tour of Coffee Creek the morning of May 11th. I'm waiting to hear back from the Department of Corrections, or possibly going to the Marion County Jail if that doesn't work. So
yeah.
I'm trying to work that out for Wednesday or Thursday of next week.
So please keep that in mind. And what we're trying to do, we'll do it within our time slot. There's been some discussion of maybe doing something jointly with the House committee. That's still kind of in the works. And that would more than likely, well, it could be for either of those. Our committee normally goes to a state facility or two during session, and so this will be an opportunity. But more importantly for me is that it sounds like we may have an opportunity to do the county, which is Marion County is where we would be going, and I think that in itself is would be an appropriate thing for us to see as to what's happening at the local level, as to how it differs from the state facilities and what they have to offer. So we'll work on those. And then the other thing is regarding Tuesday, I'm not sure how many bills we have.
We have, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, four bills and one work session. We have House Bill 2986, which is the probate bill from the Oregon Law Commission. House Bill 2251, which I believe comes from the Department of Corrections, specifying that persons under the age of 18 should not be within the Department of Corrections. House Bill 3030A, which deals with the prohibition of a sale of nitrous oxide or whippets.
Okay.
And House Bill 2622A deals with banks being able to freeze transactions that they think might be fraudulent or resulting from elder abuse.
Okay. So the Whippets one is set for this coming Tuesday?
It is. Okay. We have an amendment that just came in today.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and say that we're going to change our start time for Tuesday. We'll start at 8:15. I like to have that extra 15 minutes because we've been bumping up against the 10 o'clock error. And that way we should be able to do it. We may have a class coming in from Cottage Grove on that bill. My office has been in contact with them, so we will get word out to them, and hopefully that will work for their schedule because they gave some some of them were here to give testimony on the House side, and I believe they'd like to come back. And on that bill, I will tell you, when you look at it, the bill was amended on the House side, moving the age from 18 to 21. I've requested an amendment to take it back to 18, and we'll have discussions about why. You know, the bottom line is, it seems to me that we're talking about a food item or something that can, in fact, be used for food preparation, and I have some difficulty as to why we would limit someone of age at 18 from being able to purchase something that has a use besides being abused.
Like wine? Just kidding. Well, speaking of culinary arts.
Yeah, well, that's one of those situations when we're ready to go there on the, was that the 21st Amendment? We could probably do that. All right, with that, we're adjourned for the day, and we'll be back on Tuesday at 8:15.
I guess so.